if an avant-garde composer, for example, invents techniques musically that I can then find ways to use and develop in my own work, that maybe I'm able, because of the nature of working in a video game, for example, I might be able to reach more people, and there's kind of like a genetic descendant of that person's work, which meant that their biggest contribution was influencing a fellow composer more than a mass audience. In fact, so many avant-garde are kind of programmed to believe that they aren't successfully being avant-garde if they actually reach a mass audience. Like, right. Those two are directly counter to each other. Avant-garde is definitionally sort of niche and
right.
fringe, you know? I find that all very interesting. And I find it very valuable.
Yeah, I jokingly said this morning, avant-garde artists are meant to do the ugly, so we regular artists don't repeat those mistakes.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I feel pretty unsettled by what happened
because
last night.
Because of our concert?
Yes. I don't know if
unsettled.
That is...
Unsettled.
Yeah. This started because of a big lie. I thought there were going to be performers. And I thought there were going to be somebody
big
conducting.
Lie. So
yeah,
harsh.
You said, let's go to a concert. And that is what a concert means. Performing music. In my opinion, that is... Well, I was expecting that.
All right,
that.
So we're already off to an interesting place here. Because... It's funny, before we even tackle this question of the avant-garde, the whole idea of declaring a concert requires performers is interesting. So, for example, in college, I went to a bunch of recital recital-type performances where there were pure playback pieces, like we just... heard. And there was also at least one instance where it was someone had built effectively a robotic guitar that was, it didn't look like a person or really a guitar, but it was strings and then had these clamps that could slide up and down based on information from a computer, and then it would squeeze the string at the specified spot and then another thing would pluck it. So it's functioning identically to the way you play guitar, but it was like these moving, each string was moving independently. So you could do things that the human hand actually couldn't do on a guitar. And so it was a piece written for that. And the concert was coming and sitting and watching this robot move and make noise. And of course the music was highly unmemorable, but just the image of this robot was what I remembered.
I just want to make a point here. At least they're watching something performing.
So, well, last night, let's describe what we saw. It was Wild Up, which is Chris Roundtree's ensemble here in LA that does quite a lot of new music, contemporary music, music requiring atypical format or staging, kind of, we'll just call them bold and unusual.
Right.
Formats and works and that kind of thing. And they're highly engaged with contemporary music as opposed to playing Beethoven and Mozart or Stravinsky or, you know, that sort of thing. Although they've done bits of everything at one time or another. And in celebration of the Greek composer Ioannis Xenakis's 102nd birthday, posthumously, they did what they were hoping was the first in a series of concerts in honor of him. And the beginning, this one, featuring all so-called tape music or electroacoustic playback pieces of his. And do you happen to have handy what years they were from? I know you looked them up.
Oh, no, I didn't. Like, from the 70s?
I know that one of them was from the 90s because it struck me when he said that was way later than I was expecting. But
I think the 90s one is Bohor, but you probably should look it up because I don't remember. And I think he's 101,
yeah.
Not two.
Bohor is an 8-channel tape piece written in 1962.
Oh, I see.
And the...
Then I guess second, it's Hibiki Hanama.
Hibiki Hanama. It was written in 1969.
Oh, Jesus Christ. I'm not even...
That piece was created for a Japanese Iron and Steel Federation Expo. And he also designed the room in which it was to be played. Orient Occident.
That was going to be my next guess.
That's 1960.
Holy shit. Yeah, I didn't even...
yeah. And then the last one was S709, which must be the one from the 90s. Hold on. Yeah, 92. So we have three pieces basically from the 60s, and which to my ear were quintessential examples of this so-called tape music. It was a very trendy thing, especially in the 60s, and music built around electronic instruments and or recording production techniques of other recordings. And it gave birth to a movement referred to as musique concrète, which was basically, instead of relying on the recording, the sounds of traditional instruments, now anything is fair game. It's sort of the definition of postmodern, where the sound of someone typing at a typewriter might become a foundation for your piece as much as mm-hmm. some, you know, cello line or something like that. Mm-hmm. And the very boundaries of what we call music were more or less exploded.
Do you know, I just remember, will you categorize one of the scenes in Tarzan when the monkeys are playing with stuff like spoons and stuff like that? They're like making sounds, yeah. but they're making music with that. Will you consider that part of this like music concrete movement?
Maybe only in the most technical sense, but I think it's not in the spirit of it. If you're playing spoons, for example, and it's meant to sound rhythmic and sort of traditionally percussive, as if you were playing with a drumstick on a timpani or something, or a mallet rather, that's not really what music concrete was about. Music concrete was like the sound of a car engine idling, or the sound of you know, the people walking in a subway station, or, you know, all these just like sampling the world itself. And it's less about unusual choices of instruments playing normal music as it is.
Got it.
Defying what even is music. Okay. You know, is the sound of a baby crying, if you record it and play it back, is it now a piece of music because you chose to record it and play it back? Which also then is the question of, well, was it music before that? Like, where do you draw the line? Is there even a line? That was what was being explored then.
Right.
That's sort of, to me, the essence of the avant-garde, and especially the avant-garde of those days. So Xenakis, interestingly, I'm not so sure that was really what he was thinking about. I don't know huge amounts about him, but my understanding, and certainly confirmed by last night, was that he was simply looking, he was trying to write music like any other composer. I don't think he was trying to redefine what is music. He just didn't use, you know, orchestral instruments or traditional instruments, obviously particularly on these pieces, mm-hmm. In sort of conventional ways. Like he had no interest in a conventional melody or conventional harmonies or conventional rhythms. But that doesn't mean that he was necessarily trying to say, yes, but what is music? I think he would have unhesitantly said, well, yeah, of course this is music. It's just not using the tools you're used to or the language you're used to.
Right.
But in any case, so you had never been to a concert like this before.
No, I think the closest one was the one in Disney Hall.
Yeah, which really was not the same, but it does have some overlap. That was what is his name? Was it Peter Idvosh? Is that his name? Yeah, Idvosh. Idvosh? I'm not sure how to pronounce. He's Hungarian, but I'm not entirely certain how to pronounce his name. But he had a violin concerto that was being premiered at Disney Hall, and you were not a fan.
Not at all.
I think part of that is expectation. You had not heard a thing like that, and I didn't really warn you.
Yeah, you didn't say anything. Plus, I was hungry. I think that was like the tip of, you know, that was what made the night horrible for me. Like, I was hungry, and I was just listening to a bunch of violins being horrible. They want to make you have a headache. They play that piece. But this is just me. I was not open-minded. I was not in a good place, just hungry-wise, I guess. So it was pretty awful. But yesterday, for some reason, you explained this to me and you said, this is what he does. It's not going to be instruments, blah, blah, blah. But I thought there was going to be people, you know, banging stuff or...
Right. Well, that
there was nobody.
That I didn't know going in that it was going to be purely a playback piece, and I think what happened was that I had said we are invited by my friend who is a conductor, and the assumption therefore is that we are going to a show of his in which he will be conducting. I don't remember if I actually asserted he will be conducting or if it was just like, hey, my conductor friend invited us to this show. I didn't know one way or the other what to expect, only that it was going to be Xenakis, and I do have some familiarity with his music, although I mostly know his orchestral music, which of course does require a conductor. So what was your description of the concert overall? What is your description of how would you describe, it was four pieces.
Yes.
And they played them in near total darkness for the audience.
I liked that they put like yoga mats on the floor for whoever wants to listen in a different position. And I don't know how much impact does the ground. You know, I'm not sure how that works. But I was tempted to go, but you kind of like, you were not convinced because it was pretty loud.
Well, it was mostly just that people... Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, also people flooded down there so fast that I was like, I don't want to... Like,
right.
I just didn't think we'd make it in time.
Right. Honestly, besides the music and not knowing anything about this guy, I didn't know he was, you know, he suffered what he suffered. I didn't know anything. So I listened to the music and I was like, Jesus Christ, what the hell? But also I kind of like opened my mind to let myself just go with the flow and just close my eyes and try to put images to those sounds just as experiment, like thinking, if I were to make a painting out of this piece, how should it look like? So I was just thinking that, just for the sake of training my instincts as an artist. And it was pretty great. I want to play you guys a little bit of each piece. It's just four pieces, and I just
let's do them one at a time. So the first one was Hibiki Hanama.
Yeah.
So here's a little taste of that one. That was just a few seconds. Obviously, we don't want to get into copyright trouble either. But the full piece is like almost 18 minutes long. It's interesting. Chris, the founder of Wild Up, who was our host last night, Chris Roundtree, he was referring to a consistent quality to Xenakis's electronic or electroacoustic music as being all about strata. So at any given moment, you're hearing multiple layers of sound where it's very much like you can imagine an orchestra where you might have, you know, tubas and trombones kind of at the bottom end and violas and clarinets and French horns in the middle and violins and flutes and trumpets on the top end. And even without knowing what those instruments are or how to play them or anything, your ear will naturally sort of parse out the different layers. And mm-hmm. so it's fundamentally the same principle of, well, what if I have a kind of bass layer of, like he has this sort of just low rumble almost. It's almost barely audible, although last night it was so bassy that you felt it in your bones.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then this one I felt like was the most, shall we say, user-friendly.
Yeah, that was a smart decision.
Yeah, because a lot of the sounds, you can kind of guess where they came from. Like you can hear a lot of sliding strings doing this kind of what we call a glissando. That's an instantly identifiable sound, even though it sounds like he was manipulating it, because there's places where I went, that sounds like glissing strings, but it's been modified mm-hmm. somehow because mm-hmm. they don't sound like that naturally.
You said strata. What is that?
Strata just basically means layers. Okay. Like the study of geology is the one aspect of geology is what's called stratigraphy, which is the different layers, like the different rock layers,
right,
where you have, you know, the age of the earth can kind of be measured based on how deep things are, or the age of an object can be measured based on how deeply it's buried.
I see.
That's stratigraphy would be a label that you can put on that. And so strata refers to those different layers.
Can you use that also for trees?
I feel like probably, although I suspect there's like tree specific version of that word, because
I see,
for whatever reason, that pings for me. The other version you hear referring to the uppermost layer of the human of the earth atmosphere is called the stratosphere.
Of course. Well, muchas gracias, profesor.
So yeah, it fundamentally should just means layers. And so having a piece built around those different layers where, like, you hear those kind of bamboo or enclong-esque sort of where your ear immediately feels like, I don't really know what that is, but yet it's somehow familiar. It's not an inherently alien sound. It's just, it's just, there's no sense of consistent rhythm to it. There's no pattern you can detect. Mm-hmm. But it somehow becomes like its own object. It becomes this piece's version of a melody, mm-hmm. because it's like, oh, I know what that is. And when it goes away, you feel it leave, and then it comes back, and you go, ooh, this sound again. And so you realize some of those real basics of composition are still at play here, even if the vocabulary is very different. And that was a big awakening for me as a student, is realizing, it doesn't have to just be an oboe comes in and plays this beautiful melody. It can mm-hmm. be just that sound. And you can write pieces that are both, you know, there's a beautiful melody and weird sounds at the same time. That's personally a thing I really like to do. And things like this are where composers were developing that, and were, you know, this is 60 years ago. They were, or 50-ish years ago, this was where this was essentially being worked out and tried for the first time. I mean, and that sort of, to me, that's the point. If I'm bringing it back to what's theoretically today's topic, the purpose of the avant-garde is, for me, the artistic equivalent of map-making explorers, you know, like Lewis and Clark,
right,
setting off into the wilderness. They're not the ones who are building the city, which is what the kind of people who come later is. And that's what I would argue later composers are.
That totally makes sense. I was actually looking for like the actual explanation of avant-garde, and it said it comes from the term advance guard and vanguard, which is...
they're like the scouts.
It's a French, yes, it's a French military term that identified the group of soldiers that come first before the other, just to explore and see how that what you said is just like, it totally makes sense.
Yeah, they are the ones whose job is to go and find the edge.
At first, I was thinking it comes from the military, because avant-garde, it's more like on guard, like it makes people fight. And politics,
I mean,
or whatever.
That's not wrong. I mean, the history of avant-garde being associated with controversy is endless. So, I mean, that's actually a pretty good comparison.
Yeah, I also realized that it started with, it was like a political movement, just to, because of that same reason. For example, this one, Yanis, he was inspired by what he lived in the war.
Yeah, he was part of the Greek resistance to the Nazis, and he fought, he saw actual combat.
Right, right. And I didn't realize it's also, I was reading a little bit about him this morning. He basically almost died. He got hit by a, what is it called? A mortar?
Oh, yeah. Like a bomb? Yeah, like artillery explosion.
And it killed a little girl that was nearby, and it injured him and somebody else, but he lived. And half of his face is just completely damaged, like it's just like broken, and he doesn't, his eye doesn't work. And yeah, it's pretty interesting now having this like background of this works that I listened to yesterday. Now I can like understand, it's just more, I'm not gonna say enjoyable, but it's more, it opens my eyes.
Yeah, you can appreciate it more.
Right.
And interestingly, I don't know that he would find any fault with that. There was a definite belief amongst composers in those days that enjoyment is not really the point. Particularly a composer that's drawing from a kind of wartime experience. You know, it's hard to overstate what the cumulative impact of things like World War I and II, and then, you know, major political movements like the sort of radical, like the civil rights movement of the 60s and the general sort of radical leftward push that was coming from a lot of the artists, and even just the whole so-called Red Scare, which is what, you know, Americans, particularly right-wing Americans, labeled it. But that was basically this push towards progressive ideology or even communist ideology, which was being heavily driven by artists like Xenakis. I'm pretty sure he was a card-carrying communist, like so many others at that time. And so there was a spirit of radicalism where the goal was not to make a piece that you say, wow, that really moved me, but it's a piece that's meant to grab you and shake you and make you challenge your own beliefs and your own ideologies. Like it's music coming from a totally different tool set and with a totally different angle. And this was happening in theater and film and all the arts, obviously, visual arts, painters. There's examples of this happening everywhere. I mean, you know, Diego Rivera painting, you know, explicitly communist murals in Detroit, the apex of American capitalism. That's that's meant to make people get upset. That's sort of that's sort of the idea. And I always found myself of two minds, because I would say, I don't know that I have ever any interest in creating music that comes from that place, like overtly political work or shocking or controversial work, even though I appreciate it, and there's something about the courage of it that I really admire. But I also, at the end of the day, particularly after Journey came out and I got a taste of what it can be like, I became very clear that my purpose, I think, my goal is to add like comfort and peace or excitement to people's lives. And that can take the form of excitement and adrenaline. You know, that could be like an Aliens fire team or a Banner Saga or something that has a lot of excitement in it. But by creating a form of escapism, almost you are contributing to peace and not a kind of political shakeup. And I don't think it need be one or the other. And I wouldn't want to live in a world where there were no politically motivated artists. I just know that that's not really what motivates me.
You rather spend your energy doing good instead of battling.
Yeah, well, I mean, arguably those would say they are doing good, but I know what you mean, and I agree with it. It's the idea is I'd rather bring peace to someone on a personal one-to-one level than to use my energy trying to change the system, as it were.
Vox populi.
Yeah, exactly. Because I think I'm better at trying. I think that that's, I just am naturally, potentially, I think, more skilled at connecting with someone more one-to-one. than trying to kind of bring down the system or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also tend to be a believer in reform as opposed to burn it all down, but that's just me. Separate from that, though, I really do value. And last night was a wonderful reminder because it's been a long time since I went to a concert like this.
Was this a concert, though? Was this meant?
I would call it a concert. Yeah, it's because the definition of a concert was forced to expand.
This was more like a listening party, in my opinion.
I mean, okay, I don't know that I think there's a meaningful distinction between those. I recognize that if I'm releasing an album and I want to have a launch party, I might call it a listening party, and it would feel weird to put on a record and call it a concert. But this wasn't a record. It's a piece that was made to be played back for an audience. It's never...
I see.
It blurs that line of...
It was never meant to be performed by anybody, just like played. That's it. And
I mean, what even would you perform? I mean, this is manipulated sound, you know? I mean,
right.
The medium is not the orchestra or a soloist or a piano or whatever. The medium is literally tape.
All right.
But I think because it was designed to be heard by an audience.
Some of these pieces have people banging things.
Oftentimes, especially in the world of music concrete, you're not composing. You're going and finding a thing and recording it, and the composition is now what you do with the recording.
I see.
Now there are plenty of pieces though where you'll write something down, someone plays it, you record it, and then you manipulate that recording. But the final version of the piece is always meant to be that recording. It's not meant to be the thing that the person originally played. So the second one on the show was the Orient Occident, which sounds like this. This one, the very first few seconds of it is a perfect actual demonstration of what I was talking about, where it sounds like a cello, but that's no normal recording of a cello playing. Something's been done to that, and I don't know what was done, and especially because all the guesses that I would have today are not the technology he would have been using 50 years ago. And which is so cool. That was actually a lot of what I kept thinking about during the concert the listening party or whatever you want to call it.
Just analyzing.
Yeah, I found myself trying to imagine. How was this made?
On my side, I was just trying to picture. You know, like on this one, for example, I was picturing like Metropolis or, you know.
And that's definitely a generation. I would argue this is just a universal truth where whatever comes to mind for you is the right answer. There's no composers generally, I think, would not argue if you hear the wrong thing, as it were, that you're somehow wrong. Whatever inspired them becomes irrelevant in a sense. That's why, like, for example, a common thing is to have program notes where you have your little booklet and it has a few words from the composer. And I remember when I was a student, I always wanted to write pieces that required you read the program notes in order to understand. And my composition teachers would always say, you know, your piece needs to stand on its own. And if no one listens to if no one reads your notes, they should still have something from the piece. And I would argue it's both. The piece can mean one thing, and then if you suddenly, like you said, realizing he was a victim of a wartime injury totally changed your perception of what you think he was exploring with his music. And that's like now when you hear it in the future, you'll have a whole new relationship with it. But that didn't take away from your ability to find things in it the first time. So right. It's like both are true, you know?
Yeah.
I always thought it'd be cool to write a piece. I've never had the chance to do this, mostly because I'm always told it's too expensive, even though it shouldn't be that expensive. But I always wanted to write a piece where I tell the audience, please read the program notes. And then I write four totally different, like, this is a piece about the jungle. This is a piece about me thinking about childhood. This is a piece about what it is to lose a parent. And then you shuffle them around so different members of the audience are reading different things. I always thought that would be an interesting kind of experiment to run, but I'm always told, that's too much paper to, like, we want to just print one thing.
Right.
Like, okay, fine. But I think it would be fascinating to get to the audience, like, what do you think of this piece? And they're like, oh, I love just the way that paperless. It was all about childhood. That's true. That actually, I've been to concerts recently where they had an app that not only was there an app with the program notes, but they were transmitting real time where when the piece changed, the text changed for you in the app and you didn't even have to like flip the page like in a normal booklet, which I thought was
a solution.
That's a glimpse of the future. Let's listen to the third one. This is the one that was totally unlike the others. This is the one that was called...
Oh, yeah. The bees fucking.
Yes. Yes. What you called bees fucking. S709. That is a piece quite unlike the rest.
Do you know why is it called S709?
I do not know. There is a reason. This is the piece from the early 90s. 94.
Are you going to look it up?
I did Google it. It says this is basically a piece trying to explore the micro properties of a single sound that he called S709. So it sounds like he either found a sound or sampled a sound that he then tried to effectively zoom in all the way down to the atomic level and explore it, you know, at every step. I actually wrote a piece like this once where I played a single piano chord and then I tried to imagine what it would be like if you kept zooming in all the way down the way that you see those science documentaries of like, here's the Earth, and it keeps zooming in until you're down to the subatomic level. I thought, what would the musical equivalent of that, where it's a piece that is very much about the zoom in process and then zoom back out.
That feels so accurate to what we just listened, because in the concert, during the concert, when I was listening to this, I felt like I was inside of a little creature. That's what it reminded me of bee. But
it's weird because you can feel you can actually really very much feel that it's one sound that's, you know, fluttering around rapidly and getting stretched and pulled up and down and crunched together rapidly. And it's really, again, I just kept thinking, my God, knowing that this, you know, was made in a largely non-digital way, even though this is from the 90s, there wouldn't be the technology like we have today.
Can you explain how did he edit this?
I don't know in the case of this piece, but tape music from the 70s and the 60s was quite literally, you would make recordings which were on tape, or you would make recordings of things in the world or of instruments or whatever, or you would make recordings from synthesizers, like old early generation synthesizers, things like early Moogs and Buchlas and things like that, and everything would end up on the medium of tape. And then you would have these multi-track tape machines where you could combine signals, you could play the tape back at different speeds in order to slow down the pitch, speed it up. You know, people tried all kinds of, again, avant-garde techniques. You know, what happens if I slightly burn the physical tape and then I play it back? It's going to be all warped and fucked up. And you know, people would... And, of course, the real hallmark of it is the splicing, where you're taking a literal razor blade and cutting tape and mixing bits together and cross-fading bits where things kind of fade from one to the other in a multi-track tape deck. And because this is a world of, first off, there's no control Z, there's absolutely mm-hmm. no way to reverse anything that you've done, which means it's a very delicate and very risky process. And mm-hmm. It's very labor intensive. Like you could spend literally a week on a 1 second of music.
That's crazy. You told me E.T. was like that?
Well, all recording. Until basically the late 90s, most things were recorded to tape.
90s?
Yeah, the late 90s. I mean, things only started to move universally to digital as you got towards the year 2000. Like only really like advanced, experimental, like forward-thinking, tech-savvy places would have been recording digitally before that.
It's so baffling. It feels so archaic. And yet 90s doesn't feel that long ago.
I know.
Feel that.
Yeah, it's wild. You can imagine, you know, when my friend like Kenny Hall, the music editor for Jerry Goldsmith, was talking about working on all these films where, you know, the footage would change and Jerry's music was already recorded, which meant that Kenny had to music edit the final recording with the orchestra to fit the new footage. He literally had to do that with a razor blade on the originals. Like,
that's insane.
It's completely nuts and terrifying. And I remember he said on E.T., he was the music editor on E.T., that he said that the horn section, they all had colds or something and they weren't playing at their best. And there's a lot of really hard horn parts. And he said there were a lot of takes where he had to edit around, like, combine different takes in order to get the best possible horn. So he said he was splicing all over the place on some of those big cues. And it's like the idea of, you know, just a lot of razor blade. It's totally nuts. Having done it, I took a class in college where we had to do this. It's so nerve-wracking because you don't realize it until you're literally holding this razor in your hand and you're looking down, and they have these kind of like chopping blocks that you feed the razor into, so that it's kind of like those it makes it so it cuts on a straight line and you can line it up. But even still, despite this thing helping you, you just know if I fuck this up, I've ruined it. There's no getting it back. Yeah.
You didn't get the fine mutter of your dad, I suppose.
Yes, my father, the surgeon, definitely. I'm not too bad, but I would have definitely felt more confident if I had a surgeon's hand. So this piece, I don't know how this particular one was made, but it is essentially the study of a single sound.
That's the one that, to me, stand out the most.
For sure. No question.
I think there's one last one.
Yeah, the last one was Bohor.
This one felt so long, and I was just like sleepy by the end. I felt, you know, you can listen to all this noise and sounds, and I don't know, I was falling asleep for some reason. It just felt like too steady.
Yeah. Oh, it's extremely static.
Yes.
It felt like he was going out of his way to hide the source of the sounds.
Mm-hmm.
Because everything kind of reminded you of something. Like, it sounded like, I kept thinking, it sounds like we're in the inside of a factory. I feel like this clanging of metal, like machinery, but it wasn't literally that. It was almost that, as if you were hearing it with like a bag over your head or something, mm-hmm. you know, but the high ends of this piece were so intense that it was, by the end, it was quite physically almost painful, I thought, in a kind of genuinely uncomfortable way.
It gets very loud, yes.
Yeah, loud and piercing.
Yeah. I also, for this one, I kept picturing a island made of metal, hanging long tubes and bells and rusty pieces and chains, and then big storm, mm-hmm. you know, raining, all bleak and gray.
And on top of that, the unrelenting, nonstop, you know, there was never, so rarely, a kind of breath where it would dip down and get quiet and then build back up again. It was just absolutely nonstop, brutal.
Mm-hmm.
But what that does, after a while, you know, after 5 to 10 minutes of that, I was amazed at how much your ear really starts to adjust, and then the piece will change in volume by the tiniest amount, and it feels like, ooh, he's starting to dip down into kind of one of the lulls, or ooh, he's building to a climax, and mm-hmm. you realize it's wavering by such tiny amounts that if you listened to that on its own, it sounds totally flat. And to me, that's a perfect example of something the avant-garde teaches us, where I would never write a piece that is unchanging and flat and aggressive for, you know, 20 minutes just without any rest of any kind. You'd have to just have me at gunpoint, I think, to write a piece like that. But there's something so educational about knowing when you subject the human ear to that level of constant strain that it's like you go inside of it, and now you're looking around from within it, and you're realizing, right. I start to see new things. Yeah. And that's so valuable to know as a creator, that, you know, you can kind of force the listener through sheer willpower into a new way of thinking, if they have just the patience to bear with you while you kind of recalibrate them.
I think, yes, you're all in or you're not. You're out.
Yeah.
That's, I think, the mindset to listen to his work. You just gotta, you know, endure and survive.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and it's so funny because, you know, most of the time, like I went to a lot of shows like this before where it just dripped with pretentiousness, where people would say, oh, I thought that one was so lovely and touching. And they would speak about it in ways that I just thought, you can't possibly believe that. I've meant every word that I've said while we've been recording here, but I would not describe it. Like I can say all these positive things, but I would not describe it as like moving, for example, in the way that... The way that, you know, what's a good example? You know, the way that great, like Castaway moved me. You know, there's mm-hmm. nothing even approaching that sort of thing. But I am better off having heard it. I definitely think I got something of great value. And not just because I love us talking about it, but even just in the moment, where it takes you.
This is the point of avant-garde. It's so we, the non-explorers, artists, can take that exploration from them and then create something new out of it.
Yeah, that's, I think so. Every now and again, I will try, just for fun, writing a piece that uses these kinds of techniques. Although that, by definition, is no longer avant-garde, because the avant-garde needs to be doing something like... On avant-garde is not a genre, it's a mindset. I think a lot of people make that mistake. They hear a piece that sounds so-called weird, and they go, oh, that's avant-garde. And it's like, well, if you write a piece and you're taking those weird sounds and you're just using them in your own way, you're no longer on the forefront. Right. Someone has already developed that for you.
Yes.
So the only way for you to be avant-garde is to go somewhere that no one's ever been. This is why John Maucheri argues that things like film music and video game music are the new avant-garde. Because he says that you're exploring a way of reaching people and a mode of interaction that is totally new. And mm-hmm. he says, you know, we should let go of this association that avant-garde also mean that it's like assaulting or unpleasant or
mm-hmm.
alien. He goes, it doesn't need to be that. The avant-garde is simply what's the new frontier.
Right.
And he particularly looks at video games and says, that is the frontier. That is the avant-garde of the 21st uh-huh. century, which I thought was a wonderfully reasonable claim.
Music?
He does write that in there, and he's also spoken about it publicly in speeches, and it's kind of a diatribe of his that he's been arguing that point for many years, and I found it a refreshing perspective, because when I was a student, avant-garde definitely meant those people in the 60s and 70s who were creating kind of the when modernism of like the 40s and 50s became postmodernism, and now all sound is music, all including silence. That is now music is the domain of everything. And so the avant-garde is saying, you know, what's the craziest, most batshit stuff we can do? And these pieces that of Xenakis are normal compared to some of the shit. I think I told you, like, I a piece where it becomes performance art, where it was a string quartet that kept getting interrupted by a phone ringing. And so they could never play for more than a few seconds until eventually a horse just literally walked across the stage. I don't remember who the composer was on that, but that was sort of quintessentially avant-garde,
right,
of its era. And you know, a lot of people look at that and they're like, well, that's just silly. But I think as artists, we have to look at those folks and respect them as,
I think they're, you know, the point of many of them is to be impactful. It doesn't, it doesn't mean to be moving or beautiful or anything like that. It's just like to make an impact and just to make the beholder think out of, you know, just think.
And you could even argue that their most valuable contribution is the impact they have on fellow artists, more even than any sense of general public.
Right.
Because I like the idea that if an avant-garde composer, for example, invents techniques musically that I can then find ways to use and develop in my own work, that maybe I'm able, because of the nature of working in a video game, for example, I might be able to reach more people.
Right.
And there's kind of like a genetic descendant of that person's work, which meant that their biggest contribution was influencing a fellow composer more than a mass audience.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, so many avant-garde are kind of programmed to believe that they aren't successfully being avant-garde if they actually reach a mass audience. Like, those two are directly counter to each other. Avant-garde is definitionally sort of niche and fringe, you know? I find that all very interesting.
I find
it very valuable.
Yeah, I jokingly said this morning, avant-garde artists are meant to do the ugly, so we regular artists don't repeat those mistakes. But I think there's a little bit of truth.
Yeah, or we find, I think I actually totally would defend that statement and say they also find things that we might figure out ways to be, to make not ugly, you know, like to say, how do you make this experience something that actually might be very moving to somebody?
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, here's an example. I don't mean for this to sound like I'm patting myself on the back. It's just the only one that came to mind. But I did a documentary years ago, 10, 11 years ago, called The War Around Us, about these two journalists who were trapped in Gaza in 2008 when Israel started bombing right as Obama was elected. It didn't make the news much, but it was very controversial, and there was a lot of... It inflamed a lot of the Israel-Gaza, you know, Palestinian conflict, because there was a lot of criticism that Israel was being overly aggressive in their, you know, purported anti-terrorist activities. And these two journalists, Shireen Todras and Ayman Mohyeldin, were there in to cover the Palestinian reaction to Obama's election, and they weren't anticipating that the area would get sealed off and attacked by the Israeli military while they were still inside. So they have all this cell phone footage and things from being within the war zone, because no other journalists were allowed in. So they were the only source of reporting from the inside. And it is a powerful documentary, and you know, if nothing else, it gives a harrowing glimpse of what a war zone can look like and what it's like to be a civilian surrounded by rockets and bombs and fighter planes, and it's absolutely horrible. And they had a lot of raw footage that they couldn't even include in the movie because it's just so horrible. They were like, no one will ever make it through this movie. Like, this is just raw glimpses of human suffering. And so I said to the editor, I don't want to see the footage. I just frankly don't. But can you strip out the audio and give it to me? And he gave me the sounds, and it's the sounds of like a parent holding their dead child and just crying in agony in a way that you can't act. You can't, and because I said I don't, I want to do something that is out of respect and mm-hmm. and reverence for the dead and for mm-hmm. the loss, the human suffering. I don't want to just use it as a piece of manipulative opportunism, right. You know.
Uh-huh.
So I said I don't want to just try to write poignant music. I want to feature these people to make poignant music actually hard to listen to. And so the ending scene of this film, where we're hearing them describe what they witnessed as journalists, I took the sounds of these families and these people, and you hear ambulances and all that, and I mixed it together with what I was writing, and mm-hmm. that becomes the score of the film.
Wow.
And it was one of those where it's
can we make it this was hard. The album of the day?
I've never released this as an album. It's not available anywhere.
Oh.
Yeah. It was a profound experience to listen to that and then think of how can I use this in a way that sort of honors this. And I probably would never have had an idea like that if I had not had exposure to these more avant-garde music concrete kind of pieces when I mm-hmm. had been a student. And the right. idea of what happens when you mix the real world, purposely chosen snippets of the real world right. with something that you are creating, you know, whole cloth. So I think that it's about how do you make something that's really ugly and inject something potentially poignant or emotional yeah. or whatever into that, knowing that the final result might still be ugly because, in this case, this is real sounds of a real war zone,
yeah.
You know? So it's not, there's no version of that that's ever going to be beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, yeah. I honestly I was a little nervous that you were gonna it so
you
so
were
like
great by warning me what was this whole thing about. You learned from your mistakes.
That I did. Yeah, well, that's where I go. If you go in knowing what to expect, you will hopefully find something of value. But particularly because, you know, you as an artist, like I would love to see you paint something that for you feels like I'm not trying to make something beautiful, because you're so good at making things that are just instantly powerfully beautiful.
Every time we do diálogos, I'm like, this is the ugliest thing I ever done.
That's not the same. You're not allowed to criticize your own work and now call it ugly. And it doesn't have to be ugly, but I would love, I find it every few years, I'll force myself to do something that is, I guess, my version of the avant-garde, where I push myself somewhere that just feels like, I don't know if this is even good.
We should just do the fucking diálogos, you know, in private. We can record it if you want.
I think this could only be done as an angles. I couldn't do it in real time. Mm. Not true avant-garde. Because I can't improvise something that is truly like, this is not something I've ever attempted before. My fingers physically can't do that. I don't even think a piano could do that.
The muscle. Like, yeah, I get it.
Like, even the most gifted pianist on the planet, to me, avant-garde is no longer about purely instrumental music. I mean, that's sort of the whole point of all this Xenakis stuff, is you have to push somewhere totally new.
Right. Anyway, do you have an album of the day?
Looks like there's the Orchestra Sinfonica RAI... under Arturo Tamayo did a recording of Xenakis' Metastasis. That was the first piece of his I ever heard, and it made a huge impression.
That's the piece that he wrote based on his experience at the war.
I believe that is correct. It is a piece that is fundamentally a study of moving orchestral colors, and it blew me away when I heard it first time. I looked up a video of Metastasis on YouTube, and the top comment is somebody says, "What I learned from Xenakis and other composers like Penderecki and Ligeti," who Ligeti's 100th birthday was yesterday, or two days ago, something like that. And also yesterday was Danny Elfman's 70th birthday.
Oh my God.
They said, "What I learned from Xenakis and Penderecki and Ligeti and listening to their music, I learned that not all music exists to please everyone. In many cases, it's not even meant to be liked. It's meant to be listened to, studied, and thought about. It's like John Cage wanting to challenge people's conception of what music is supposed to be. If you happen to like it, then that's your taste. But if you don't, that doesn't mean that it sucks. And
yeah,
I think that
I agree.
I think that's kind of one of those, as you kind of mature and you expand your listening, you invariably come to a conclusion like that. And I think that we all have the avant-garde to thank for that, you know, to really like push us and it makes it easier to then also go, if you're somebody who only ever listened to classical music and then you go and you listen to, you know, Metallica, I think it actually makes it easier for you to appreciate them as a lateral move, because the avant-garde made you realize all of it's fair game, you know? It doesn't just benefit you going down that one rabbit hole, but all rabbit holes.
It's like saying, I do weed, but there are people that do crack.
And there's our sign out.